Welcome to The Roofer Show with your host, Dave Sullivan. You found the podcast that helps roofing contractors grow their businesses, make more money, and have more free time. Each week, Dave interviews the industry's top experts who will give you actionable tips and strategies for the real world of construction to help you take your roofing business to the next level. So let's get down to business.
Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome to the Roofer Show podcast, the place to be if you want to grow a more profitable roofing business. I'm your host, Dave Sullivan, the Roofer Coach, and I've been a successful roofing contractor for over 30 years, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned. Check out our website at theroofershow.com, where you can get tips, strategies, and free downloads to help you grow a more profitable roofing business. W-2 employees or 1099 subcontractors? What's the right classification, and what are you doing to pay your salespeople and perhaps your sub crews? As of March 1st, enforcement has changed. Things have really been turned upside down. So you're going to want to listen to this. I've got Philip Siegel, our labor attorney for over 20 years, who has gone through a number of audits and these problems in the past with us. Philip's been on a number of times, knows his stuff, particularly when it comes to this issue. And it is a big issue because you just read the roofing forms and there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion. So you're going to want to know the facts and what you should be looking at, whether you're going to just say, hey, I'm going to roll the dice. What's the chance of getting caught? And if I do, what's going to happen? So that's what we're going to get into today. But before we do, I want to thank our sponsor, and that is Ruby. The number one problem that homeowners have when they're looking for roofing services, their biggest complaint is contractors don't answer their phones. It's as simple as that. Drives them crazy. So this is what Ruby does. They are remote receptionists. They answer your phone with a professional, friendly voice. They answer it quickly, and they tee up the sale. If you're rolling these calls over in a voicemail, they're not going to leave a message. They're just going to go to another contractor where they can speak with a live person that's going to answer the questions that they've got, and you've just squandered another opportunity to sell a job. That's why so many of the contractors that we work with use Ruby, so they can do the things that are important, like going out and selling jobs and running your business. So check out Ruby at call.ruby.com/theroofercoach. Find out what they're about so you look like a professional organization and not Chuck in the truck. And if you'd be interested in joining a group of like-minded, non-competing contractors from around the country to find out what they're doing to run a successful business, you want to check out our mastermind groups. We've got a couple of spots left in our group that's between $1 and $6 million in annual sales. Keep everybody the same type of work. It's a great group. You're going to want to check this out. And also, if you're a smaller contractor, we're starting up a new group for contractors from startup to under $1 million. How to become a $1 million roofing contractor. Check it out. Get in touch with me and we can talk about it. I can go through the details, but you get a lot out of these groups. I've always been in masterminds and it helped me in my business. All right, well, let's get into our interview with John and Philip. Philip, what is going on? It's great to see you again.
Dave, hey, man. Good to see you. Thank you for having me.
It's been a while. We've got John DeLaurier from Peach State Roofing. But, Philip, we've probably done half dozen shows together. So everybody's going to want to go back and check those out because we talk about everything legal, how to stay out of trouble. You can avoid some big headaches. We've got a situation now, which I want to talk about, which is why I dragged you back in here. We want to talk about this new issue that's come up that I can see in all the roofing forms, And this is the changes that have been made when it comes to 1099 employees versus W-2 employees. It's always been a problem. We've had shows going back over 5 years ago, I think, when we've been talking about this. It's always been an issue, potential issue, but now things have really heated up. There's a lot of misunderstanding. So now we've got the pro, the labor attorney that understands all this. It's going to give us all of the answers. So let's start off with what's going on. What's the big deal?
All right. Well, Dave, this is a big deal, particularly for the construction industry. And then I think there's even a more greater focus on the roofing industry. What's happened is the Department of Labor very recently published its final rule on what is referred to as the misclassification issue, determining whether a worker is an independent contractor or an employee. Now, this isn't new. There had been a rule in place, but what happened significantly is that, you know, the Department of Labor, it's run by a person that is appointed by the President of the United States. And in this instance, we had a change in the party in the White House. We had the Trump administration and its Department of Labor had a rule on this issue that is now no longer the rule effective March 11th, because the Biden administration has come in and published its own rule, and in doing that, rescinds the Trump rule. And it's significant because, as we'll get into here, the Trump rule really, I would say, has a low bar that needed to be cleared to properly classify someone as an independent contractor. And the Biden administration comes into the office and says, okay, we think the Trump Department of Labor misinterpreted existing case law, prior precedent, and we're going to go and implement a rule that now has the effect of raising that bar. So it's almost as if there's been a 180-degree change that makes it a significantly more difficult to make the argument that a worker is an independent contractor rather than an employee.
So let's start off with the basics, the difference between 1099 and W-2. And there's a big difference when it comes to costs in doing this. Right, John? We've had this discussion. We just got out of our mastermind group, and this is hot. I mean, everybody wants to do this, and we're talking about, okay, well, I can't afford to do this. It's going to cost me too much. It's going to put me out of business. What are my chances of getting caught, actually, and so forth? So, John, why don't you lead this conversation, because you're dealing with it every day.
Well, I'm excited to be talking with Philip today. Philip has helped me out on a couple occasions. The first time I was introduced to Philip was on your podcast. So it really works, Dave. You really do bring super valuable people, and Philip definitely has helped me on a couple of occasions. So I'm excited to be talking about this particular subject, because we're always trying to do the right thing from a leadership perspective in our company. And that has everything related to the classification of different parts of our team. So one thing that I have noticed in everything you just said, Dave, is true. Like, how much can I do to not get caught is like the mentality for most people. Well, you can't really do that with the new classification, the way this is set up, and you need to understand. And before we hit record, Philip talked about a couple different exemptions that I'm excited to be diving into to hopefully shed some light on and give some clarity to most of us in this like smaller to mid-size residential roofing contractor trying to be competitive, trying to provide quality, but actually trying to stay in business as well. So, so let's talk about a couple different things: sales reps, 1099 W-2, and then let's talk about crews who actually do the production, the installation part. Those are the two kind of things that I hear need to be classified correctly, or are they being abused in some way? I think let's just start with those two groups. And Philip, let us know how should we be set up, or what are your recommendations for most small to mid-size roofing contractors specifically, and what does this all mean to us?
So for your audience, John and Dave, the cost here and the way your question is coming to me from the people who are running these businesses, because they're aware of the new rule and they understand that potentially they're not classifying their workers correctly. And I'm getting calls asking, okay, if I bring these people in as W-2 employees, what is going to be the added expense to me? And the conversation beyond just the payroll taxes that are necessary part of employing an individual as an employee. A lot of the calls I'm getting, these independent contractors are, for example, regularly working, you know, over 40 hours, whether that's as a salesman or as a crew leader or the installer crew. And the person that's calling me understands that and hitting on what Dave said, what's the expense? Well, an independent contractor, you don't have to worry about minimum wage requirements. You're not paying overtime. The law is only overtime rules only apply with a non-exempt employee, and the minimum wage obligation similar, only with a non-exempt employee. These people that are misclassified as independent contractors are, again, typically working over 40 hours. The roofing contractor's calling me and saying, okay, am I going to have this added expense for overtime when I bring these people on? And John, we then next explore, well, let's look and see if you're going to make this transition, if you've determined that the risk-benefit analysis is such that you need to bring these people on as employees, then we're looking and determining, is there an exemption that applies that would avoid the roofing contractor having to pay overtime for that individual that was an independent contractor and now is an employee working more than 40 hours. With regard to the salesman, the other part of this question is that, Philip, can I continue to pay 100% commission to this commission salesman if they're an employee? And what we look to do in those instances, does that salesman qualify for what is commonly referred to as the outside sales exemption under the Fair Labor Standards Act? If you have an individual that is regularly and customarily engaged in outside sales, then they potentially qualify for the exemption. But what needs to happen here is these sales can't be occurring at your office. Or if it's an individual that's working out of their home, the home is considered an extension of the office. On the other hand, if these salespeople, and I'll get to the others you identified, John, if the salespeople are meeting the customer out at the customer site, at the home, door-to-door sale, you know, now we're in a situation where we've got a really good argument that person's going to qualify for the outside sales exemption. You're going to continue to be able to pay commission only, and you're not going to have the minimum wage and overtime obligation. The trick with that worker is going to be, you know, knowing that there are going to be payroll taxes, adjusting maybe the commission plan so there's no morale issue, you know, that the worker that was an independent contractor is now going to be an employee. Are they going to be taking home the same pay? With regard to that crew leader, you know, the first thing I explained to the people that are calling is, you don't just have to be worried about the crew leader. You know, if the crew leader is going to be deemed an employee under the law, there's a significant likelihood the crew is as well. And in that instance, can we avoid paying overtime to the crew leader and the crew? Well, the crew leader may qualify most commonly for the executive exemption. And I say that because if we're bringing the crew on as employees as well, this crew leader is going to be in a position potentially where they're supervising the equivalent of two or more full-time employees. I mean, if that crew is a crew of the crew leader and two workers full-time, we've cleared that hurdle. And if you empower the crew leader with the ability to participate meaningfully in hiring and firing decisions, now you've got that foreman, excuse me, that crew leader that you may be calling a foreman as an employee. You may be fitting them in the executive exemption. I, you know, also have had the crew, not so much. I mean, the laborer who's doing the roofing work, unlikely to qualify for any of the exemptions. But among other calls I've fielded over the last month or so, some companies are engaging independent contractors to do their estimating. And in that instance, we're exploring whether the administrative exemption applies to avoid any minimum wage or overtime obligation. At the end of the day, it's getting the roofing contractor the information they need to be making an informed decision. You know, Dave asked, you know, how are we going to get caught? There's a variety of different scenarios that can result in a company getting caught. The one that I am seeing that is somewhat new to the landscape, in light of the new rule that was issued effective just a month ago, March 11th, being a labor and employment attorney in the construction industry, I'm doing OSHA defense work throughout the country, residential and commercial contractors. No one's immune from it. But clearly in the inspection process, in the documents that are being asked from the company, the questions that are being asked by the of the company from the compliance officer are certainly exploring this issue when the roofing contractor is reporting to the compliance officer that, wait a minute, that's a subcontractor, that's a separate business that committed the fall protection violation, that didn't have the ladder set up at the house correctly. And compliance officers clearly have a charging order to explore whether the crew is properly classified when the roofing contractor that's in, you know, dealing with OSHA says it was a sub that was committing the violation. There are others. I mean,
but you're saying if an employee gets hurt, for instance,
that's another one, Dave.
Yeah. Because that's where I see the problem. You know, they're going to be sitting around on their, on the couch getting better. And that's why all his attorney ambulance chasers, you know, are in the middle of the day.
So there's that. You'll have the person that gets injured, and they'll go to an attorney and or figure it out on their own that there's workers' comp benefits that are potentially out there, but they, you know, only available to employees. And now you have someone saying, well, I was misclassified. I'm entitled to those workers' comp benefits, in addition to what other benefits you're providing to your employees in the classification at issue. The other one, Dave, and John, I haven't experienced this in the last 6 weeks, but I note this misclassification issue, while it's new in terms of the Biden administration's new rule, this has been a relatively hot topic for years. Before the Trump rule, you had states figuring they were losing tax revenue and they were focusing on this. And when that was happening, the work wasn't as plentiful as it is right now. You'll have the independent contractor where you no longer have work available to that person. Now they want to claim unemployment benefits. Mm. Forget workers' comp, unemployment benefits. And they'll make the claim that they were an employee, and they'll make that claim to your Department of Labor unemployment examiner. And now the State Department of Labor is on and alerted to the issue, and that'll be explored. Those are two big scenarios. And then it's just the disgruntled worker who, you know, here's at a cocktail party. You know, you should be getting time and a half if you're working more than 40 hours, and they're not. And then, you know, they bring a claim. You know, as I'm hearing myself say all this, you know, a lot of these contractors, and I've got the benefit, as you noted, Dave, and I'm very appreciative of how often you've had me on. And I've been doing this a long time now. And John, you never got in enough trouble to keep me busy, but I will say
I did that for 20 years.
it's just, I haven't had the winning case. And it's a tough conversation to have, but if companies ultimately need to determine for themselves and, you know, whether they're going to, you know, make the change or not. And I often hear, as you noted, you know, I can't stay in business competitively if I do this. I get that. And you'll wait until you get caught. The unemployment, the workers' comp, the person who's regularly worked 40 hours learns they may have should have been getting overtime. You know, those are where the problem areas lie.
I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, and that is SMA Support. These guys are great. They provide a fantastic service that so many contractors need. We're talking about giving you an inside salesperson to prep estimates, follow up with customers, and even help manage your schedule, all without the headache of hiring and training. Or fill in the operations gap to ensure that jobs are scheduled and permits are pulled, and walk your customer through that five-star experience and even get that five-star review. SMA Support handles all the behind-the-scenes work so you can focus on what you do best. Imagine your roofing business with no more dropped balls and don't have tasks falling through the cracks. So check out SMA Support at smasupport.us and tell them Dave sent you. what's going to happen if I do get caught? I mean, what's a potential risk? And this came up in our mastermind group right before we got on. And one of our contractors, they picked it up in the workers' comp audit.
So,
he got fined. It was huge.
Yeah, the workers' comp audit, I unfortunately have handled that one time and again, where at the end of the year, your clients, your listeners are getting audited by their workers' comp, and the workers' comp people are determining that these subcontractors were misclassified. There's the potential for claims, and now they're added into the premium analysis. And, you know, Dave, I've routinely have seen six-figure premium hits on that. And in those cases in particular, the roofing contractor that's called me for assistance just didn't do a good job of maintaining proper documentation. You know, one of the things that they could have done, and, you know, this would behoove your viewers and listeners that are struggling with what to do, you know, certainly it helps to have these people that we're calling independent contractors actually operating under some form of corporate structure, LLC, corporation. You'll certainly want to be collecting certificates of insurance from these people, confirming that they have, you know, the typical insurance policies in place.
Most of these guys don't have insurance. And one of our members mentioned that they had to cover these crews under their insurance. Now,
to me,
that's just calling them employees right off the bat.
Well, there's two scenarios. So we may be stepping into a scenario that's unique to workers' comp. I mean, even in a scenario where your viewer or listener has engaged a true subcontractor, there's no question it's a subcontractor in construction specific to workers' comp. If that subcontractor didn't carry workers' comp, the injured employee of that subcontractor goes to the next entity up the chain to claim on their workers' comp. The general contractor, for example, the next level up, would be deemed, as it's referred to under the law in most states, the statutory employer. And because that general contractor didn't confirm the sub had workers' comp, their policy will be called. That is what that happens. You know, again, I'm giving it to you right now in the context of a true subcontractor. But where the misclassification has occurred, you're still going to get up the chain. And also, Dave, to answer your question, that potentially opens the door for, you know, other issues. One, the workers' comp premium audit that occurs at the end of the fiscal year for that company. You have to be worried about, you know, are these people going to be claiming back wages? You know, did they work 40 hours, more than 40 hours? That overtime is going to be owed if so. It's a two-year look-back period. And if the person bringing the claim, whether that's a plaintiff's attorney or an auditor for the government, determines that the violation was willful, they'll look back a third year. Any back wages that are owed, whatever that dollar amount is, under the law, unless you can argue that you got advice from an accountant or an attorney to do it a certain way, you're paying whatever back wages are owed twice. It's automatically doubled. Called liquidated.
That's what happened in our case with our member.
And you know, Dave and John, these people that are bringing these claims, they don't need to go to the EEOC. They can hire an attorney. And once they do that, you're going to be paying attorney's fees. It's the prevailing party gets attorney's fees, and there's also the likelihood of, you know, interest as well. And the attorney's fees can be significant. I mean, you may only owe $10,000 in back wages, but the fees may be in excess of $50,000. And then, you know, if it's a crew, you multiply that times, you know, however many people are on the crew. And then there's the tax liability, which really is beyond my area of expertise, but there will be a payroll tax liability as well and potential civil penalty.
I do have a question. This is very, very good. I have two questions, and it, like you said, about the taxes. So the scenario with sales, going back into the conversation, sales reps, they have the exemption. Let's say that they qualify for the exemption. They can be paid 100% commission. Now you have to factor in payroll tax. Do you have resources for our listeners, viewers, that they could calculate that? Let's say the commission structure.
Yeah.
Has that changed?
John, great question. The IRS does offer a site devoted to this issue. I believe that there are tools available there for you to figure that out, but certainly touching base with the company accountant, you'd get a quick answer.
Yeah. I think that question is going to be, I'm super excited about the exemption possibility for a lot of people, but just understanding, I mean, being able to explain to someone they're going to make X, and there's all kinds of compensation structures for sales reps. That's a super common question. But then being able to show them, and I really like that it's from the IRS too, because it's like, no, look, this is the same. We're going to pay this. Like, if you're able to be transparent with your sales reps, the morale thing that you mentioned is a huge deal. And then losing the sales rep as well, because they'll just go to the next company that's not willing to go W-2 and play by the rules.
Yeah.
So that if you show them, hey, this is why we don't want to get caught. We don't want to do the wrong thing. We want to be ethical and above board. This is why we're doing this. It's really, really important to have those resources from the ownership perspective. That's the first thing. That's very, very helpful. The second thing about the production side of things, about crews and talking about overtime, a lot of the contractors that I know, they use multiple different production crews, and they don't have 5 days a week of work. There's not 40 hours a week for any particular crew ever. This is a majority of the people that I talk to. They're using multiple crews, and those crews are also working for other contractors as well. How does that, I mean, maybe too deep of a question, but in general, what are the guidelines? If you're listening to this, watching this, because I have multiple crews. Yeah. And we don't have 40 hours of work for any of our crews ever. We've never had that. So how does that translate? Because my previous understanding was, those would be the definition of a subcontractor if they're working for us 1 day a week, maybe.
Yeah, potentially. So a few things. One, to start back with your salesperson, yeah, there's the morale issue in terms of, you know, netting their pay so there's no loss in income. I do want to make one other point, though, before I get to the back end of what you were asking about. Often I hear, well, Philip, these people want to be classified as independent contractors.
Yes.
I hear that a lot. But the law also provides that rights that are afforded under the Fair Labor Standards Act, think minimum wage, think overtime pay, they cannot be waived. So it's, you know, if the law comes in and determines an individual is misclassified, it's no defense to say, well, they waived their entitlement to those benefits that are afforded an employee because they agreed and they wanted to be an independent contractor. Not a defense, period, hard stop. The other thing I wanted to note is, you know, with regard to these crews that you're talking about not having 40 hours a week, well, two things. One, I think I just hit on it, making sure, you know, we're trying to make a good argument that they're properly classified as independent contractors. The fact that they're working for, I'm going to come back to the six factors, and I'll hit on what the two factors were under Trump here in a second. But you ought to, for sure, as we get into the factors, have a contract that makes clear that, you know, you may have a master contract and you could issue separate work orders as the work becomes available. But the master contract needs to really have a few key provisions. This isn't going to win the day automatically, but it's going to give you some bare evidence to put you in the win column. Number one, a provision where, despite what I just got done saying, the contractor recognizes that it's an independent contractor relationship. Number two, there's a provision that expressly states that the sub is within their rights to refuse work if you have a job available to them. And number three, provision in there that says and has both parties recognizing that the sub is working for other roofing contractors. Those are three very important provisions. Now, John, let's look at the current six factors. But actually, I'm going to frame this, because under the Trump administration, as I explained, the bar was a lot lower than it is today to successfully classify someone as an independent contractor. The Trump Department of Labor focused on two core factors, and that is the amount of control that's exercised by the employer, or how much control is retained by the worker, and setting their own schedule, deciding their own work. And then number two, you know, did they have the ability to make a profit if they performed efficiently? And the inverse is, if they were inefficient, was there a likelihood that they could suffer a loss? Two factors that remain part of the analysis, but there are only two of other factors that I'll expand on in a second. But those two factors, again, made it really easy to classify someone as an independent contractor. Now, the Biden administration says, yeah, we're going to still consider the worker's opportunity for profit or loss. And we're going to consider the nature and degree of the control over the work, but we're going to add in four other factors. And it's these four factors that, you know, really shift the scales here. One, it's considering the investment made by the worker and the employer. These crews that you're talking about, you know, you're the bigger company out there getting work to be able to subcontract out. You're making an investment to grow your business. I would be asking you, you're doing everything right with the sub, you know, got the contract in place, they have their insurance, they're set up as a corporation, they're working for other people. All right, are they making an investment to get more work? Are they advertising? You know, what are they doing? They're not going to be spending the same amount of dollars as a Peach State Roofing, but are they making similar investments, maybe on a much lower scale? Those types of investments. And it sounds silly, but in some of these audits, you know, Dave, you mentioned the workers' comp audit. I've been able to get out of one by just showing that the sub had an ad in the yellow pages. I mean, who's using the yellow pages? But we were able to show that they had an advertisement, and really that made the investigator go away.
That is amazing. This is a great, great point, actually, that I did not know, was not aware of, because our subs actually do invest in their own marketing, and they
incredibly important under the new analysis. Yep. Number three is one you've already hit on. It's the degree of permanence of the relationship. If you're making these people go from job to job to job to job, that's one in the loss column. But bringing your facts into this discussion, it's not a permanent relationship if they're actually working for other companies.
Yep.
And, you know, it may be that you have to create that break in the relationship. Sometimes when I get engaged in a problematic situation, I'm having, or maybe we think we're going to get caught, we're setting up a spreadsheet, we're identifying how often the crew has worked for your company. And when there's no break in the relationship, I'm having to tell the company,
yeah,
our client, you need to create that break. And again, I've been doing this a long time. The client's going to say to me, well, if I stop, you know, if I go, you know, do a job without them, I'm going to lose them, and,
yep,
and they're going to start working for someone, yep, else. Well, you've just crystallized that you're doing it wrong,
yep, you know,
that you've misclassified these people. And then we get into the risk benefit analysis.
Another thing,
the other factor, go ahead, John.
I was going to say, the verbiage that we use whenever either myself, another sales rep, or our production manager, we do provide work orders, but we are always using questions, as in, when can you do these jobs? Does that play a factor in any of these investigations? Because
we never
say, hey, we need you to be here on Thursday, whatever day. We always say, hey, what's your schedule? When can you do this job? This is what it is. Here's the work order. And that's intentional.
That stuff is amazingly helpful. Make sure you keep those records of those conversations, emails.
Yep, they're all recorded.
Safe place.
Yep.
Incredibly helpful. The other factor out there, two more, is the extent to which the work is integral to the employer's business. So some of your listeners and viewers may hear that and think that sounds like the ABC test, which is a test that exists in California and in some other states throughout the country. They make it even tougher than the Department of Labor has just put out there. And if you're engaging in the states that look at the ABC test, California being one of them, if you're hiring a roofer to do your roofing work, you lose right there. In this analysis, though, it's only one factor among others. I have had the roofing contractor who employs no roofers, like you suggested. All the work is done by a sub crew, and you know, it's kind of like that Uber argument. When Uber was under the microscope here, they wanted to argue, well, we're not a rideshare service. We're a broker. We broker between the guy who's looking for the ride and the driver. Well, it's, you know, that argument's worked its way into construction. you know, you're not advertising this, but when you get caught, you're saying, well, we're not really a roofing company. We're just trying to broker between the people that do the work and the people that need the services. Yeah, that, when you got nothing else to go on, that's what your argument is. But I feel pretty good about the company that has the sub crew and is working with a number of different sub crews, calling on different, and sometimes that's intentional, knowing that this misclassification mm-hmm. exists. You know, we're going to have a variety of crews that are available to us, and we're going to pick and choose wisely on how and when we engage.
John, how do you track this stuff? I mean, for our audience, you know, you're usually pretty dialed into this.
Are you trying to give me a free plug for ProLine? Is that what you're doing right now? Yeah. So every, we have a software company, and every text message, every email, every phone call is recorded. And so we have all that. If anyone ever needed it, we would just provide it for them. So that's.
And do you use a contract with your subs?
Yeah, they have a subcontractor agreement. There's specifications, and Philip listed those that we have. We have a really good, we've used it for years, and it's really, really good.
The other thing is, and John, I think you hit on this, you don't want to be setting the price. I mean, don't dictate, this is what we pay per square. You know, I get that happens. That's why I'm talking about it. But, you know, it's a better fact pattern to have the crew leader negotiate depending on the variables of the different job. Those kind of things seem little, but they really go a long way.
Yeah, we have a written confirmation in our messages with our work orders. Hey, and we send, we really want to help our subcontractors by showing them the job before they get there the day of. So we're having pictures. They're getting to see the scope of work a lot more detailed, so that if we think it's X amount of dollars and they're like, no, it's not, we're like, hey, we want, because genuinely, if you want to help your subcontractor succeed, which I do, I don't want them to feel like they're being devalued. So I want them to agree to a fair price. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a standardized. We have an idea, but we're always asking, hey, is this a good price for this job? And we've been doing this. I've worked with one of my crews for over 10 years. They work for 10 other contractors, but we have a really, really healthy relationship that we're even to this day asking, hey, when can you do this job? Here's a location, here's the scope of work, and is this a fair price for this? And they're like, yes, let's do it.
All very helpful. Let me give you another one that seems, from my seat, a little easier to implement. Having these subs make an investment in their own safety training. You know, I get that some of our clients that have this issue are providing the training for the crews. And there's an OSHA obligation. One can argue an OSHA obligation, you know, exists that we're doing that, and it shouldn't play into the misclassification analysis. But it sure helps on that factor that considers the investment if they're providing their own training of their own crew and giving you the certification that they've done that. And the other thing you want to avoid, again, is having an independent contractor working side by side with an employee. Yep. If you're going to sub out a job, let's keep that job entirely. You know, don't have any of your employees doing the same work as the people you're calling independent contractors. Because it helps us to be able to argue, well, you know, we got spread too thin, that we needed a sub because we couldn't self-perform the work. And typically, in a scenario like that, we've got grounds to argue that maybe, you know, we're in the right.
So I know John's got to run. You do run a successful roofing business, so I understand that. But in wrapping this up, just to kind of summarize, correct me if I'm wrong. One is, this is a potential problem, and you're seeing this in your law practice, that and more where people are getting caught. Let's say they're paying fines. It is a potential problem that has really increased recently, and it could be very costly. Okay. However, that's a choice that you have to make, risk reward, whether or not you're going to make these changes. That's that.
I don't want to open up another whole hour, but you know, we've talked about this issue in the context of the national the Fair Labor Standards Act and wage and hour issues. this is also a hot topic, and the department, the National Labor Relations Board, has ruled also on this issue. Now, the test is a little different, and it's only really noteworthy for those of your listeners or viewers that are non-union. An independent contractor doesn't have a rights to, you know, negotiate or bargain collectively concerning the terms and conditions of employment, where employees do. The National Labor Relations Board, within the last year or so, issued a ruling that turned what was the rule under the Trump administration on its head. And now you have, for those of even, you know, residential roofing companies, if there's a workforce of independent contractors that are talking about wanting to get with the union, it's a lower bar in that context for them to argue that they are employees with rights under the National Labor Relations Act. So it could come up even, you know, not just in the wage and hour context.
Okay. I determined that I'm going to roll the dice. I'm going to go out of business otherwise or whatever. And I think what you're saying is that if that's the case, you should do these certain things to, as you say, put more in the win column for you if you do have a problem.
Yeah, 100%. You know, the contract is critical. We've talked through some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some low-hanging fruit there that can give you a colorable argument, but you know you're doing it wrong if by determining how difficult it would be and how impactful it would be on your business if you did bring them over as employees. The other advice is, you know, avoid the high visible jobs. I mean, you know, we're building a new stadium here, and you know, the Department of Labor swoops down and they're investigating everybody. You know, maybe not such a big likelihood involving a residential roofer working in a subdivision, but if it's near the expressway, you know, be careful.
John, let's wrap us up.
It was very informative, Philip. Like, I was good to see you, but I think this is a really, really valuable episode. I actually learned a lot, and I'm just about the exemptions, about things that I need to do in my business. What is the best way for people to get a hold of you? Because I did years ago. Sure. We worked together years ago, and I genuinely saw value working with you. And I think that this is a huge, huge deal for a lot of roofing contractors who want to do the right thing.
Sure. So my direct line at the office is 404-469-9197. That's 404-469-9197. My email address, pjs@hpsslaw.com. Our website, hpsslaw.com. You can check out my firm. I'm happy to help.
That's awesome. We'll put all this stuff in the show notes too.
If our listeners have some questions and so forth, you're always very friendly and always willing to help out contractors, right?
Yeah, happy to take an initial phone call. Your friend of Dave or John, just holler at me, and we'll get you on the right path. And if there's more to handle, we'll take you all the way.
Hey, always love having you on, Philip. We got to get you back because I don't think our legal issues have, most of these have not gone away. We've probably got a few more that we should really discuss, but always great to see you, John. Go out there and sell some roofs, and we will see you next week.
Bye. Thanks, bye. Guys.
All right. Well, that's it for our show today. I really appreciate everybody listening. If you're stuck in the mud in your business, you're just not making the progress that you think you should, getting that company organized, on track, understanding your numbers, and running it like a real business, get in touch with me. We can talk about our coaching services, our mastermind groups, and our fractional CFO services, where you'll learn the numbers. You'll learn to understand a P&L, a balance sheet, a cash flow analysis, and start running your business by the numbers. Get in touch with me. We can talk about it, and I can give you the details. Nothing else, give you a few tips on how to run a more profitable roofing business. We'll see you next week on The Roofer Show.